Society podcast in partnership with Insurance Nerds. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Bill Husted. In this episode, we'll be discussing how to set up a successful internal business transfer and sale, along with succeeding in the financial services industry. Bill is an author, entrepreneur, and small business expert. During his 32 years as a business owner, Bill grew a company specializing in highly customized retirement, health, and welfare benefits and business planning for client companies and their employees. In 2017, Bill retired and relocated to Texas after closing the internal ownership ladder sale of his company. Following more than a year of taking stock, reflection, and fun, Bill created Ownership Ladder to share the mindset and life expertise to help potential entrepreneurs to the life they have been dreaming about. Bill has been a frequent speaker at financial services conference on topics such as building your practice, retirement income, and using technology. Bill also served as a member of the Committee for the Fiduciary Standard. Good morning and welcome, Bill.
Hi. Again, good morning, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thank you for joining me. Looking forward to this episode.
I am too.
Fantastic. Well, let's talk a little bit about who you are. What do you do?
Great. Well, I continue to be happily retired, although I am fully engaged at the same time in promoting my book, which is my current life passion. I'm a member of two Toastmasters clubs. I have a middle school girl and a high school girl, and that transportation activity keeps me quite busy.
And, oh, yeah.
So I have a full life. My wife is out in the other room trying to keep the dogs under control so they don't try to come and lick us while we're podcasting today.
Well, special guests, right?
Hopefully not, actually.
So fantastic. Well, glad that you've turned the page to a new career. So, you know, let's go back to the start just to so people can find out who you are. How did you get started in the insurance business?
Well, it was a circuitous route. I didn't aim for the insurance business, for financial services, or even for business itself. I was, as a teenager, recruited to work in a ski shop because the owners knew my parents and they said, hey, Bill's kind of handy. Can he put some bikes together for us? And they taught me how to put bikes together one summer and kept me on. And so I spent quite a few years in the ski business.
Oh,
went
fantastic.
To New Zealand to manage a ski shop, came back, got a job in another ski shop, met my first wife. And she said, hey, I know about some friends in Hawaii who are going to start a health food store. Let's go help them. So we ended up going to the big island of Hawaii, the very southernmost community in the USA called Na'alehu, and started the southernmost health food store in the USA in 1979. And after cleaning refrigerators and sweeping the floor for a couple of years, I realized that was not all that. Just not all that at all. I said, you know, we got to go back to the mainland. And so back we came, and my brother said, so what are you going to do? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, why don't you get a job as a bank teller? You can count, can't you? I said, well, yeah, I can count. So I got a job as a bank teller, and they found me to be interesting enough that they put me on management training pretty soon. And then I was old enough to ask this question to my dad. And we went skiing one day. And when I got into banking, suddenly he and I could start actually conversing, having interesting conversations. And before, he was a capitalist pig and I was not. And I had to interest in whatever he was doing. Well, then I'd grown up enough. And we went skiing one day and I said, hey, Dad, what is it you do exactly? And he spent the day regaling me with stories of sell agreements and employee benefits and this newfangled thing. It was 1984. He had just been to the $1 million roundtable. And this was his third career. He owned a lumber brokerage. He owned a short-haul truck line. He sold it, retired for a little while. And then a friend said, hey, come take over my dad's pension business. And so we spent that day learning, him teaching me about this newfangled thing called the 401k plan, which he had just heard Ted Bennis speak of at the $1 million roundtable. He was teaching, you know, unveiling it to the world. A few people like Fidelity, this new mutual fund company back then.
Oh, yeah.
And started to get some traction with it. And we started to do that business together after I said at the end of that day, wow, that is so cool what you're doing. Can I join you? Which was the unheard of question in the family, really. That the least likely person to go join Dad in his business was me. So that's how I got involved in the insurance business. It was much more interesting than banking. And here I am.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm still waiting for that first person to tell me that they grew up. Oh, I'm getting a little bit of an echo.
From my side or from you?
From me. Oh, I think it's gone away. Let me make a quick note of the time so we can have this edited out.
Sure.
Let's see, where are we in the video time?
Technology is great until it's a pain.
Yeah. Let's see, we're about 7 minutes in.
Get water here.
Yeah, I'm still getting a little bit of the echo. I'm going to just mute and unmute real quick.
Okay.
Okay, let me see. Huh? Okay, it seems to have gone away. If it comes back, I'll just get rid of the headset. Right. So let's plunge back in. So I'm still waiting to meet that first person who says that was their big dream growing up to come into the insurance business. I'm sure you know, you've been doing this for a while. I came into the industry about when you did. Pretty much everybody I've talked to just sort of fell into the insurance business in some way or another.
Now, ironically, right before I got hired by the bank, I applied to this company called Phoenix Mutual, and they gave me their test and they said, no, you're totally unsuited for this business. Go away.
Oh, I remember those old tests that they had at the insurance agencies. They weren't very good at predicting anything, but people really believed in giving them. So anyway, you mentioned the $1 million roundtable, and I think that's, you know, maybe a lot of our listeners are in the property and casualty industry. The $1 million roundtable is an organization on the life insurance side that you qualify for by placing a lot of business, and it's a huge honor to qualify. And Bill, you've qualified for both the court of the table and the top of the table, which is a very exclusive number of people that qualify for that. What is your secret to success? What got you up to the court of the table and top of the table?
You know, it was interesting that I just worked the business. It wasn't really a strategic plan of mine to get the court of the table or top of the table. It was more my plan to grow the business and do what we were doing in a better way each and every year. And by doing that, just working that idea and that kind of thinking, it happened. A lot of $1 million roundtable folks are probably shrugging at this point going, but you know, I had to strategize and decide how to do it and get there. And that just wasn't really my plan. My plan was to work the business that I had purchased from my dad and grow it and make it really more significant.
Well, that's great. And I think that's an important lesson for our listeners is, I'm getting the feedback again. I'm going to just pause the recording for a second. All right. So, yeah, I think that's a great point that you make, that it's really not about concentrating on focusing on the end result, but on serving your clients and on growing your business and working your business. If you keep an eye on your business, good things will follow if you do what you're supposed to do. You know, so in addition to the sales success, you served as a member of the Committee for the Fiduciary Standard. How did you decide to get involved with that?
That was an interesting transition. I was, we had a significant amount of pension business as well as 401k business, which is kind of an odd thing since pensions are a fading reality, except in the public sector. And one time I got fired. And why did I get fired? Because a guy came in and made a pitch that was totally based on fiduciary concepts and a fee-based fee structure, as opposed to a commission-based structure. We came up in the insurance business, so we were commission-oriented. Mm-hmm. And this was a large enough plan that insurance company that kept the business, since they didn't have to pay commission, they could pay whatever fee, whatever. I started working with the wholesaler and I said, so what gives? And he said, well, you got to convert to a fee-based business. That's mm-hmm. where it's going. And I said, okay, that's what we're doing. And in order to charge a fee, you have to take not just the insurance test and not just a securities broker's test, but you have to take an investment advisor's test and get certified as a registered investment advisor. Then you can declare yourself an investment fiduciary on the investment side, which is now the norm in retirement plans. Mm-hmm. Nearly everybody who is a significant player in retirement plans is an investment fiduciary. And so just as part of that, I started becoming, it's a joke, so hopefully nobody will take it the wrong way, but I became a fiduciary Nazi, kind of like the suit Nazi on Seinfeld. You know, if you weren't that, you just...
Shoot. I'm not having a good morning here on the recording. Sorry about that.
Okay, we'll roll back and I'll see. You need, is that like water all over the floor or coffee all over the floor?
No, it was a water bottle. I was just trying to adjust my lighting. Sorry about that. All right, let's pick up. So you were talking
I became like the soup Nazi on Seinfeld, where if you weren't a fiduciary, you really weren't seeking the best interests of the client on the retirement plan side. And that was probably halfway into my career. It was probably now 20 years ago. And as I gradually migrated our business from an investment commission-based business to an advisory fee-based business where we were a fiduciary on everything, to take on that kind of liability, the lawyers who teach on the subject at the retirement plan meetings say, well, you are liable right down to your cufflinks. Wow. And since I don't wear cufflinks, I couldn't afford to lose them. And I began to educate myself. And the Committee for the Fiduciary Standard is one of the advocacy groups that simply says, if you're doing retirement plan business, you shouldn't be doing it unless you are accepting the liabilities that go along with the advice you're giving.
Definitely. Well, you know, it's something, you know, I wrote an article in 1995, for AM Best, you know, stating that, you know, my thought, and this was with another insurance consultant, that the days of commissions were numbered in the insurance industry. And that day has not come yet. But, you know, the work that is done by the Committee on the Fiduciary Standard was amazing. But, you know, it seems like it's kind of faded into the background. I mean, given the current regulatory climate, do you think it's going to make a comeback, that whole thought pattern of moving to more fee-based products and advice?
You know, the distinction between an insurance commission and an investment advisory fee is quite different. pricing, when you look at the pricing formulas for an insurance product, if you charge a fee or if they amortize a commission, the numbers don't change that dramatically. But in an investment, in the investment world, they do change dramatically because everything is real time. If you charge a 5% upfront mutual fund commission, that comes right out of the consumer's pocket. If you charge 0.25% over time, that comes out of the consumer's pocket too, but it's an amortization on the advisor's part. And it demands a definite service package that is explicit, that is understood by all parties, and it's an accountability function. How to translate that into the insurance world? I think it's probably easier to do, though I don't know that much about P&C pricing, but it's possibly easier to do there than it is on the life and annuity side. There, because the you know, a auto policy, for example, is a one-year transaction. The broker and I have to decide, well, is that the right company to stay with for next year? Usually it is, but if some other pricing comes in, there's really no cash value, there's no future value, there's no surrender charge to take into account. So it's a much more fluid kind of situation, similar to investments. That's where, that's the parallel I see, is that if I don't like mutual fund A, but I want to be in the category that it's covering, international large companies, just as an example. Okay, I'll fire them and I hire somebody else, and overnight the money's in the new deal and the pricing's different and the philosophy is different, but I'm still in the category. Similar, auto insurance, well, fire them and overnight I'm with a new company, I still have coverage, I can drive and not be exposed to, you know, unlimited liabilities. I didn't have insurance, so kind of the parallel I'm drawing. With life insurance, the longevity is of the policy might be 50 years. The amortization of a commission over a 50-year period of time, it irons out to be a relatively tiny number. And you really wouldn't want to charge a fee to a consumer that is equal to the fee or the commission that is paid on a life product or a long-term care, or long-term disability, that kind of thing.
Definitely. Well, I'm sure we could cover a whole episode just with that. Okay. Those are some great points. And you know, that probably answers the question of why, at least in the life insurance side, we haven't seen those types of products succeed. A number of companies have launched different no-load and low-load concepts, and they just haven't caught on. So let's transition into what you're doing now. You know, I'd like to go back to 30 years ago where you purchased a business from your father, because, you know, to talk a little bit about what that process was like and how that led into what you're doing now.
Yeah, love to. He proposed to me a couple years in. We were having this amazingly good father, son, mentor, protege kind of relationship. And I'm a learning sponge. It's just my nature. I don't care much. I never cared much for the educational mode of doing it, but when it's because I want to do it, I just eat it up. And he could tell I was eating up everything we were doing. And he said to me a couple of years in, you know, you should buy this company from me. He was early 60s at the time. I said, whoa, what do you mean? Where's that money going to come from? Literally, I was just scared to death. My wife and I had just scraped together some money with her sister's help to put a down payment on a little house and putting, you know, $20 a month in a 401k plan was like a mind-blowing experience. It was just my level of sophistication wasn't high at that time. And he said, well, just relax. It's okay. There's plenty of time. Don't worry about it. So some time went by, and and he groomed me, and he consciously walked through the succession conversation with other clients, and me with them, and invited me to participate in that kind of conversation with other clients. So it became about other people and how do other people solve it. And that taught me one of the principles that he really preached when it got serious. And that is, he said to me, look, don't worry about it. The business will buy itself.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, what do you mean? He says, the cash flow is going to be there the day after I retire, just like it's going to be there the day before I retire. Where's the cash flow going today? Going in my pocket, it's going in your pocket. The day after I retire, there's going to be more going in your pocket. I said, huh? Like that, right? That mm-hmm. sounds good. And you're going to take some of what was going into my pocket and keep paying me, and I'm not going to work. And I said, oh. He says, that's how the business buys itself. Every business buys itself. Mm-hmm. He had sold his lumber brokerage, and that's where he started to learn this lesson. He had sold his truck line, and that's how he learned this lesson. Almost every business is tiny, actually. And mm-hmm. very few businesses are that marketable. And once you get clear on that idea, that the whole media frenzy over IPOs and venture capital and all of that stuff, that's a very, very small part of the business universe. Mm-hmm. Most businesses these days especially are not built around machinery and big plants and big real estate holdings. Those companies are in a different universe than most of the business universe. Most businesses I learned over the process of writing this book average 10 employees.
Wow.
And they're intellectual property businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not really a roll-up opportunity in most cases. Now, there's some exceptions, but for the most part, they're not. So this is the principle of him teaching me the business buys itself. The business, to do that, has to have continuity. The owner who is leaving has to be careful enough that they get enough money that it's good for them on the back end,
mm-hmm.
but not take so much that it collapses the business. Because if it does, if it's so much for the buyer that it's really not worth it to hassle with, the mm-hmm. buyer will walk. Then yeah. what does the former owner have? Nothing. Now, what do most advisors tell a lot of small businesses to do? These are the CPAs, the lawyers, the valuation guys. Just liquidate. Well, if you've got some stuff, it's a retail store, and you have some product on the shelves, you have a blowout sale, store closing, and you sell off all the furniture and all the stuff off the shelves, and you know, you put $100,000 or $200,000 or something in your pocket, and you pay off the trade receivables or payables, and you have a little money left. That's common advice for a small business. Continuity, which is what Dad taught me, is much better. Mm-hmm. And so I took that lesson to heart. It gave him 15 years of additional retirement security. It gave me a lifetime career, mm-hmm. and it built the idea in me that we could do this again. That's how I got started on the writing the book.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And I think that translates so well to, as you know, the insurance industry, because, you know, there's so many small operations, you know, be it a direct sale agent to a broker, MGA, whatever title you want to use, there's so many small operations that are operated by one or two people. And that's always, you know, the question, how, you know, at some point, how do I separate myself from the business, but also continue the business for a next generation to continue to service the clients? And I think, you know, that's where you know, solutions you offer with the ownership ladder come into play. And, you know, so how did you evolve the idea to where you were able to sell your business and develop the concept of the ownership ladder?
Well, it took a mere 30 years. It's like an overnight success musician who's got gray hair. Suddenly they're known, right?
Exactly.
So I hired somebody 10 years before I ultimately sold to her. And my reality was, as I mentioned, my two kids, we adopted two girls from China. We were late bloomers. I was 50. My wife was 49. They're now in middle school and high school. Our son, who was 12 when I married my wife, is just not a business guy. Mm-hmm. Had no interest in it, never showed any interest, never mentioned any interest. And so a family succession was simply impractical. My girls harassed me today. Hey, Dad, how come you didn't keep the business so you could hand it down to me? I said, well, you know, I'd be a geezer by the time you'd be even near ready, and the business might not exist anymore. So in my 50s, I started to realize that this preaching we had always done with our clientele, and I, even though I had pension business, 401k business, health and welfare benefits, I always continued, because our clientele was small business, continued to talk about succession planning and buy sell and that sort of thing with our clients and ensure those needs. So as my protege, Mary, started to grow in the business, it started to become clear that she had definitely long-term commitment to this as a career. This was not something she was doing for a job. Mm-hmm. It was a career to her. And she took it seriously, and she worked it very hard, and she contributed a lot. And so it becomes, and I think this is for your listeners who are the owners, if I waited until I'm 64 in about a month, mm-hmm. if I waited until now to say, I ought to get a retirement thing going on here, because mm-hmm. I'm, you know, Social Security's coming next year, maybe a couple of years from now. I should think about it. No, the time that they need to think about and the time I started thinking about was in my 50s. And I started realizing that there were some roll-up opportunities. And I explored one and did the math on it. Well, I don't want anything to do with that. You know, one of the things that's interesting about it, I think a lot of us small business entrepreneurs, is we become unemployable. Mm-hmm. Because we're used to doing it our way. And that's the problem with a lot of M&A situations, is that the new owner, you're now their employee. Mm-hmm. They say, well, you're going to be a consultant. You know, we need you to stick around for a couple of years. You're their employee. And that's just really a difficult position to be in. So I began to work with Mary and bring it up to her. Mm-hmm. When I get ready to retire, let's figure out how to transfer ownership to you. She was in. And so we had created this whole fancy, complicated ownership transition program where she was going to do an earn-in. Mm-hmm. And I was going to do a workout, and I would work until I was 70. Well, about the time that was all happening, we literally had signed papers. It was all ready to go. The lawyering was done. We went and called on a new prospect, pretty significant international company, and pitched them on their U.S. 401k operations. And they said, yeah, you're hired. Awesome. So we're meeting with the HR people early in the relationship to talk about how we implement our system. And we said, by the way, we can do your health and welfare benefits. And they said, mm-hmm. no. So, well, yeah, we do that. And they said, no, you'll never do that. Hmm. And I said, what? We'll never do that. Right. Roger and Candy do that. And they'll always do that for us. So let's talk about 401k. But by the way, he's not getting any younger. Maybe you should talk to him. Well, I had, you know, a lot of, there aren't that many huge cities in the U.S. Portland, Oregon is not a huge city. So everybody knows everybody. So I had known of him. And so I called him. I said, let's have lunch. And I said, have you ever thought about, you know, retiring? He said, yeah, actually I have. I just don't quite know how I'm going to go about it. But I have Candy, and she's the one. I've told her all along, someday you're going to own this. And I said, well, how about if we figure out how to do that? And he says, yeah, I'd love that. So I came back to the office and I said to Mary, this was not on the plan, but it's how, you know, serendipitous life is sometimes, right? I said, you know, there's this opportunity for us to merge with this other practice. And so fitting into the 10-year plan we got going on, that could be really good. But if you hate her, this is not going to work at all. So why don't you go take her to coffee and just talk and see if you guys like each other. Well, not only did they like each other, they were just this train that suddenly was loaded and rocketing down the tracks because they could both see. Candy had had promises made. Mary had a deal. They could both see that the opportunity was to put this together and have a really significant business. So we literally within months had merged the businesses, and as I went through the process of that, I realized, you know, the math doesn't work for me to be a principal in the benefits business. The math works for me to sell them my benefits business and let them buy his benefits business. Then Mary and I will keep working the retirement business. And so that was the starting point. And rather than occupying all of the airtime, I'm going to let you pose a question here.
Well, I'm curious. Can you get into this is fascinating because I know this is a huge issue for so many people in the financial services industry. Can you talk a little bit about the mechanics of how it works, the ownership ladder concept?
Yeah. So it, as I mentioned with my dad, it really is a matter of the owner being rational about the financials. Okay, there aren't that many small businesses that are that liquid that just happen to have key employees who have a spare $100,000 in their pocket.
Yeah.
Right? Just everybody is living well. Well, we live well and we do well. We still, from a certain perspective, live month to month. We got a monthly mortgage. We got monthly groceries. We got kids who have school situations. We got new cars to buy, insurance premiums to pay, all of that stuff, right? So the owner has to start from the point of view of taking off the filter that says, I have to get all my money up front. That's number one. You go at it with that point of view, you probably will have your business die and then you will die and you will both be old and there will be nothing left of the business. And you will have had to work in your business for 20 or 30 more years. So if you let that go, you can start looking at, well, so how could we make this work? In my dad's case and in my case, I didn't require a down payment. It required monthly payments. And you just have to do the spreadsheets and say, what's the predictable cash flows of the business? What is a good owner's compensation? Maybe not what you're taking out of the business, because if we're successful, we're taking out quite a lot and we say, well, that's my owner's compensation. But really, there's a lot of profit on top of the actual work-based compensation that you're taking in most cases. Because, in the 401k and pension business, one of the things that was just part of the job of the consultant was to know what everybody got paid. why, because non-discrimination testing requires that as part of the formula. So I saw pay. Owners in almost every business make a lot of money. So you gotta go from the point of view of, well, you know, 400 is my number, to, yeah, but the business can't pay me 400 and keep going with a new owner. What are they supposed to do? Live on 40,000 a year for 10 years while you get your 400, and, you know. So you have to get over that. That's really part of the hurdle as a seller, is what works. Think about it as a what works situation. What does the business need to keep functioning and running on all cylinders? What does the new owner need to make it so that screwing it up is way worse than the great situation of keeping it going? If they're in a good situation, they will never screw it up. Why would they? And then you figure out, based on those two factors, how much can the business sustain and pay me? What's the value of the business? So therefore, how many years is it going to take? So what did I do? I gave them 22 years. Why 22? Because that's how the math worked out well for everybody. They are already, because they combined the two businesses and because of their young age and their right, they were right at the peak influential point in their careers, my two buyers. And so what have they done with the business? It's vastly bigger than I ever could have did make it. And so my financial security is I'm still a number significant to their formula, but I'm not pigging out on their revenue and their work in such a way that it's at all hard for them to continue to run the business and keep paying. Meanwhile, my family and I get to live a pretty comfortable life because of the combination of our other, I mean, that doesn't mean an owner doesn't have money in 401k and other investments, do other planning. Can't think your business is your whole retirement. But as a core, it's your major investment. It's your major asset.
Well, I think actually that is an amazing point, because, you know, as I was thinking about it, is, you know, the way you describe it, it's almost an annuity for you.
It is an annuity. I love annuities, by the way.
I think annuities, you know, have gotten a bad rap overall. You know, unfortunately, some companies have twisted them and earned that reputation. But I think the concept, you know, especially in this type of scenario, is a wonderful way. It works for everybody. But I think the core value that I'm hearing from you is that you can't be greedy. You need to be realistic and to share. You know, maybe that principle, you know, I don't know if you remember that old, everything I need to know I learned in kindergarten, you know, and, you know, to share, you know.
Sure. Without being stupid on either side of the equation.
Yeah.
That's where it takes the spreadsheeting. You'll have to either hire yourself a spreadsheeter, or you'll have to train yourself to be a spreadsheeter, or maybe you are one. But that's the way you can just tinker with the numbers. And a lot of people want to make business transactions, you know, fancier than that. But really, it's a matter of you build a spreadsheet, you see how the numbers flow, and you watch it. You say, does this work on all sides of the equation? If it does, and it works well, then its likelihood is it's going to keep working well. So the other piece of this equation, though, is, and it's a really important part, it's mentoring the successors. A lot of people think, well, I'm going to sell it to my kid. And they'll be, you know, they're my kid. I trust them. They'll be good. Okay, that might work. And in many cases, it does. But in many cases, it doesn't. And it's really a matter of looking at that whole person and saying, are they really committed to the whole package here? To the kind of business we're in, to perpetuating this business, do they have a vision for where it should go? Because a lot of us tend to think, well, I know it all. No, we don't. Mm-hmm. So when it's time to get out of the way, if they really have a passion, that business, because it's this really nice platform we've built up over the years, mm-hmm. I took the platform my dad built and built it many times bigger. They are taking the platform that I built and that Roger built and taking it way many times bigger than that. And ideally, a few years down the road, they will have grown it to the point where they really are an acquisition target. Mm-hmm. At a certain scale, businesses become acquisition targets. But they have to be of a significance that the buyer really sees a financial asset at that point, not just a, you know, most, that's one of the things I talk about in business beyond that is really part of this mentoring equation, I think. Mm-hmm. It is the mentality of an owner that is looking for an angel buyer, like mm-hmm. the tech companies get angel investors. Mm-hmm. An angel buyer is a fantasy for most businesses. Why? Because an angel buyer in a 10-person business, the owner has to work there. An angel mm-hmm. buyer never wants to work there. Mm-hmm. They want to give you $500,000, and in 5 years, they want $5 million back, and they don't want to work. They want to walk in and say, what the hell are you doing? Do it better, and walk out and wait for their $5 million to come. So they can take that $5 million and buy 5 more businesses, each worth $1 million, and do the same thing. That's their mentality. Oh, yeah. Most small businesses need a person that works it. So as you're mentoring your person, that's really the equation to be looking at. Are they a worker? A lot of people like to use the word, I'm an entrepreneur. Well, you know, entrepreneur is a startup mentality. Mm-hmm. After a couple of years of entrepreneurs, if you don't have a going business concern that is a business, then you are a business owner, but you're really not, it's not a thing, mm-hmm. right? Entrepreneurship is not really a thing in my book. Ownership is a thing. That's why I called it the ownership ladder, by the way, is because, entrepreneur is a great buzzword. Everybody likes, especially the press. They love that. Mm-hmm. They love to talk about it. And colleges like to teach entrepreneur classes. Well, I think they should teach business owner classes because that's where most of the activity in the universe is.
Definitely. Well, I think one thing is I'm not going to tell Entrepreneur Magazine about this interview. They'd be highly disappointed.
If they ask me to write an article or I get to, you know, I'm gonna spin it a bit different.
So, you know, have a couple wrap-up questions, but I think a big one is a lot of people in the Insurance Nerds audience are younger in their careers. So how can they position themselves, you know, to be the type of person who could participate in an ownership ladder type situation? What advice would you give somebody who's young?
Yeah. I saw it often. I never did it myself, but there are people who are, and I've seen it in the securities business more than I've seen it in the insurance business, but a person with a book of business who is getting ready to retire and a young business owner who is building their business, mm-hmm. if they think of an ownership ladder in the context of themselves rolling up a business and saying, oh, well, there's another agency down the street. He's a good guy. He's got 2 or 3 people and obviously drives a nice car and he lives in a nice part of town, probably successful. And he probably mm-hmm. wants to retire at some point. And in the same token as we've been talking, his opportunity to be rolled up, he may not be that big. He may not be that significant in a, you know, you need to be there talking to your clientele on a one-on-one basis to keep the trust. Mm-hmm. This younger person can think of it in that way, that they could acquire other books of business through understanding the ownership ladder and being, even if they don't work there or they don't work there for a long time, they could use the ideas here to position themselves with those business owners. The other thing that is important, I think, for younger business people to do is take every action in the business that is designed with a mentality that I am growing a business to be a long-term asset. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting next month's car payment with this transaction. I'm building my business. And as I build my business, I am making a marketable entity and a marketable organization. So what does that mean? I got to have good records. I got to maintain financials of the business that are completely separate from my own. I have to hire professionals to make sure that my legal, my accounting, my operational functions are really well defined, so that over time, as you build, because businesses gain value by having proof. Mm-hmm. Because it's a mental, I mean, that it's mostly mental assets. So mm-hmm. What's the proof? Well, you've got a track record, you've got clients. If you have a great CRM that tracks all of your client relationships over time, those become part of your marketing package. And then as you grow older and you start to see yourself as a mentor and grow your own personal Mary and Candy in your practice, mm-hmm. so that they can become owners. And frankly, it was true of me. I kissed a lot of frogs throughout the process of trying to find the succession partner. Kept doing it for quite a lot of years. Kept bringing in people, thinking, well, this will be a partner, and eventually they'll buy me out. Be ready to say, you're out.
Well, I think that's an important point, is that it is about the fit. And this is so interesting. There's so much to explore here. And I think this is going to be extremely helpful to those in the industry, you know, who either own their small agency or brokerage, you know, whatever operation that they have and are looking, you know, a lot of us in the insurance industry are graying out and, you know, it's time for a new generation. I think the insurance industry is kind of hitting a refresh point. I don't know if you share that view. You know, the question I always like to wrap up with is, you know, getting your number one tip on being financially prepared. You know, what have you learned, and what would be that one tip that you would leave, you know, either consumers or advisors with about being financially prepared?
Put your money in your 401k too.
That is excellent, because, you know, I think that's something, I can't remember the statistic, how many people don't take advantage of the 401k match, and that's something I can never understand, walking away from that free money.
Exactly. Well, and if you're the owner of the business, you have to create a 401k, and it costs you money to do it, but the long-term benefit of that to you and to everybody else, because you don't get to just cram in all you want without bringing your folks along. That's just that's the non-discrimination rules that are existing, and they're fair. They're right. So build your plan so that it makes it possible for you to maximize it for yourself, so that you have, it's one of your multiple assets that you can rely on for your monthly paychecks when it comes time.
Boy, that sounds really close to the concept of the ownership ladder.
The whole thing is really, really tied together. There are, you know, and you brought up annuities earlier. I'm just going to refresh on that for a moment. Social Security really is an annuity. Mm-hmm. Your 401k, regardless of how you extract the money from it, it really is an annuity. your ownership in the business and the way you finance and help the person finance the exit is an annuity. But I can guarantee you, especially as an early retiree, because health insurance costs continue.
Mm-hmm.
A family, the cost of an old guy buying health insurance is ridiculously expensive. You need a pretty healthy annuity to go buy yourself some health insurance if you're going to early mm-hmm. retire. So my advice actually is to try to stick it out till you're 60.
Uh-huh.
I mean, 65, excuse me. I was 60 when I exited, and it was the right thing for my people, my buyers. I would have been in the way if I had stuck around and really distracted from and detracted from the success of the business. So I did, but from a financial point of view, if you can find somebody else to pay your health insurance like Medicare, it's a good thing.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I'm not making a pitch for some of those politicians.
Well, I think, you know, it's unfortunate. I know, you know, in working with financial planners, you know, over the years and consulting for them, that health insurance is always one of the big topics for people is, you know, what do you do with that health insurance premium in retirement and, you know, pre-retirement? Thank you so much for coming on today. Where can people learn more about you and the ownership ladder?
So I'm going to grab a copy. So the book cover, which you see here, is changing on Amazon.com because Amazon's background is white, as I discovered after I published
it.
And this book cover, while beautiful, and I love this handshake, it's so significant, but doesn't pop off of the page of Amazon. So the new book cover, don't be looking for this cover when you go looking for the ownership ladder. You will still find the ownership ladder, but it will be mostly orange with a kind of a torn front icon to it.
Okay.
And so you can go to Amazon and buy the book. If you are an Amazon, a Kindle Unlimited reader, you can read it for free. I have it heavily discounted right now, so you can get a copy of it for a very low price. I would love to have people connect with me on LinkedIn. So Bill Hestand, H-E-E-S-T-A-N-D, LinkedIn/Bill Hestand. Connect with me. That's where I do a lot of communicating. I'm part of a bunch of different groups, and I just enjoy participating in those groups. On my website, theownershipladder.com, you can join the mailing list. You can get a free copy of the summary version of this book, which is basically all of the section summaries.
Mm-hmm.
I precede each of the group, there's four sections in the book, and so I precede each of them with a summary section. So if somebody wants a quick and easy overview of the book, join my mailing list at ownershipladder.com and you'll get emailed a PDF of that. If you want to buy it, you can go to amazon.com and buy and pay me money for it. But
well, and for our listeners, all of the, you know, in case you didn't have your pen out or you're listening to this on the go, is all the links will be in the show notes. So you can just, you know, at your convenience, check out the show notes and find out different ways to connect with Bill and find out what he's up to. Bill, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Tony, I've really enjoyed it. Great conversation. Hopefully it's helping somebody.
I think it'll help a lot of the audience out there.